Thank you very much for everybody, Becker. I'll try to be brief. I'd like to discuss a number of issues that were brought up by many of the panelists. I'd like to set the tone for my remarks by quoting a more important and more famous physician from the medieval period, a commentator on the Chumash, the Sephorno, who was a doctor in addition to being a rabbi. He comments on, 2 weeks ago we read, a week ago actually, but two Shabbases ago we read, can you hear me? Okay. Two Shabbases ago we read the incident at the end of Parshas Bahalosfa when Miriam, Moses' sister, and his brother Aaron had spoke disparagingly about Moshe, and as a result Miriam was stricken with tsaras, whatever tsaras actually is, some form of skin lesion. As a result of that, Moshe prayed on behalf of his sister Miriam in a very brief, very beautiful prayer of Kael na rafah na Allah, please heal her, God. The Sephorno comments that one of the motivations behind Moshe's praying for his sister, in addition to undoubtedly her physical suffering, was, in the words of the Sephorno, Babakasha, please God, ani shoel, I request shetisrape, Chitarape Atala, that you should heal her immediately, Vlonitztarech Lebaisha, so that we shouldn't need to embarrass her and humiliate her, the Hotsia Futz Lamachane, to extricate her from the community and isolate her from the community, because somebody who's stricken with this metaphysical and physical element of Tsaras was required to be positioned in isolation outside of the entire Jewish camps. So therefore Moshe was, in addition to undoubtedly being concerned about her physical suffering, was perhaps more concerned about her emotional suffering, and specifically her isolation from the community. With that in mind, I think it's important to bear in mind, some of the panelists have referred to the isolation, the loss of independence, that a person with dementia, Alzheimer's dementia, and other forms of dementia experience. I have the privilege, what I consider to be a privilege, one of the more satisfying aspects of my week, is that on every Friday morning I go to an institute in New York. I'm not plugging their institution necessarily. It happens to be that I do go there once a week. They're housed in another institute, a senior citizen living center on the Upper West Side, the Esplanade. And inside the Esplanade, there is an independent institution that rents two floors, the second and the seventh floor, called the Hearthstone Institute, which specializes in Alzheimer's and dementia care for patients. The second floor is the more early stage Alzheimer's patients, and the seventh floor is more advanced. So every Friday morning I go, and I used to actually, this perhaps doesn't speak so highly about them, I used to go actually and spend a half an hour with the advanced patients and half an hour with the early stage patients, and we used to sing Shalom Aleichem, we used to make a little kiddush, drink some grape juice, make hamotzi over challah, sing a little tzur mishalo achalu, and this would stimulate them. Obviously different for the advanced stage patients as opposed to the early stage. But after a while they decided, partly because of budgetary issues, which I'm not quite sure I fully understand, because you won't believe what I was charging just to go there, basically covering my challah and my kit and my grape juice. They decided to try to consolidate the two floors, which is not possible clinically, it's not, or socially. And so basically I've been restricted now to just the second floor of early stage patients. But either way, I have this privilege once a week to interact with Alzheimer's patients, early dementia. And one of the most striking things that perhaps we take for granted until we've been in touch with such patients is the fact that, as you can well imagine, these units, the second and seventh, unlike the other floors in that building, are locked units. You can't get in, you can't get out unless someone keys you in, brings you through the elevator, lets you out, gives you the code. That loss of that simplistic level of loss of independence, leaving out the other aspects of loss of independence, that loss of independence, that isolation, if you will, from the rest of the world without someone being able to bring you back into the world, just to bring you downstairs to walk on West End Avenue or to take you to, I'm forgetting the name of the shopping center around the corner, Fairway, right around the corner on Broadway and 74th. That loss of independence is something that we must be sensitive to, and that I believe Halacha and Torah is sensitive to, and that's what Moshe Rabbeinu was sensitive to with guarding his sister, that isolation, that loss of independence. Every Alzheimer's patient, I think one comment that I'd like to make that I didn't at least catch the panel making earlier, was that every Alzheimer's, although it was probably implied, every Alzheimer's patient has to be viewed as an individual, because every patient, although there are commonalities to the syndrome and to the symptomatology that they may present, each one comes from being an individual person. Every person had a different personality before they developed Alzheimer's, and therefore that will manifest itself and implement, that will carry itself through in terms of their disease process, certainly in the earlier stages, maybe even through the later. There's a woman, almost every Friday, when I go to the Alzheimer's patients and I ask them if they want some more grape juice, she will always tell me, yes, half an inch. She will always describe how much grape juice she wants as half an inch, because of, certainly there's a certain personality to her that's different than the other people. Some of them laugh, some of them don't, some of them smile, some of them don't, some of them tell bad puns like I do, some of them don't. Every person is an individual, and it's important to understand Alzheimer's disease in terms of the individual person as an individual as well. I'd like to share some halakhic issues that I think are important regarding Alzheimer's. I don't believe that I have all the answers or that all of the issues are necessarily resolved to this point in time. I think it requires more evaluation. But a little, I'd like to touch upon some ideas, some of which Dr. Bennett referred to and some which other panelists referred to in their presentation. One issue that comes up regarding Alzheimer's patients has to do with the obligations of a child to a parent. Rambam writes, Maimonides writes, Mishenitrefa daito shel aviv o shel imo. I'm going to hold off on the translation for a moment. Mishtada linhog imohem kefi daitom ad sheyirucham aleihem. Ve'im yefsher lolamo b'pnei shenishtatu b'yoser, yanicham v'yelech lo v'yitzav al acherim lahanhigam keroi lahem. Maimonides writes, and this is codified in the Shulchan Aruch and the Code of Jewish Law as well, based on the Talmudic passage, though there are some additions that Maimonides adds that are not explicit in the Talmudic presentation. Let me just give you a translation based on the father of Jewish medical ethics, Rabbi Dr. Lord Emanuel Jacobowitz, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who in his monumental work, Jewish Medical Ethics, back in the 1950s as part of his PhD dissertation work, translates this passage in Maimonides as follows. He whose father or mother has become mentally unbalanced must demean himself fittingly with them as far as their capacity will permit, until compassion and relief will be vouchsafed to them, until they'll be granted compassion and perhaps recover. But if they have turned so excessively insane that he can no longer stand it, the son can no longer, he may go away and leave them as long as he instructs others to look after them properly. So I'd like to discuss this passage, Maimonides, because I think there are three important ideas in this one halacha of Maimonides of the Rambam. At the very basic level, there's the idea that Dr. Bennett referred to, that there are times that a child is not permitted to deal with a parent in terms of servicing the parent. And the reason for that is because the child has certain restrictions of disgracing a parent that perhaps others don't. An example of practical halacha. One of the prominent poskim of the rabbinic assizes in Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, who sits on the Beis Din Yerushalayim, who I had the privilege of meeting many, many years ago, when his wife was actually still living, she no longer is, was the Tzitz Eliezer, Eliezer Waldenberg. And he was asked a question by apparently a young rabbinic scholar in Jerusalem whose mother was nitrifa. She became demented, or she developed some kind of mental illness. He doesn't describe it as necessarily Alzheimer's, but some kind of tirifadas, where the mind is not working properly, the cognitive abilities are not there. And as a result, Mafriya Betzura Harifa, this mother of his, was in a very sharp way unsettling the Shalom Bayis, was disrupting the family dynamics as apparently she was living with him. In Mutterlo, the Kasher Bechevel El Kisei, is the son permitted to restrain his mother, physically restrain her with arm restraints, Kifi Pekudas HaRofei, according to the instructions of the physician, Kadesh Lo Tishlola, so she shouldn't wander off and walk out of the home, something that Dr. Bennett and others had referred to earlier. So Rabbi Lazar Waldenberg goes into a detailed halachic discussion, discusses this Rambam, and comes to the conclusion that the son doesn't have that permissibility at all. As a son, I am not permitted to do things that are disgraceful to my parent. I'm not permitted to physically restrain them. I'm never permitted to yell at them. As much as I, as a son, may experience certain, if you will, emotional pain myself when my parent accuses me of attempted rape, or my parent screams at me, or my parent insults me, in spite of all of that, as difficult as all of that is, a child doesn't have the right or permit to disgrace his parent, to yell at his parent, even for their benefit, to physically restrain the parent. And therefore, when that is of necessity for the patient, then the child has to withdraw himself. It's not just an opting out. It's not just a permit. It's a responsibility that the son has to withdraw himself. Not totally. Doesn't mean that he goes off and lives in another city necessarily, but he withdraws from certain aspects of the interaction and the care of his parent and lets others who are, if you will, outsiders and not as required by the Torah in terms of kibud avim, parent-child responsibilities, and people who perhaps might not be as sensitively affected by things that the parent may say, although that's not always the case either. So in those situations, the child has to kind of relinquish his responsibilities to others. That itself is kibud avim. By allowing others to intervene, not feeling that I have to do everything for the parent, because on the contrary, if I try to do everything, I will undoubtedly cause harm to my parent by disgracing them, by physically restraining them, by doing things that are not what a son should do, and therefore I should relinquish it. But what this Rambam also teaches us, that a son should not always think that I have to do everything for my parent and that I can't entail other people involved. I can't bring other healthcare professionals involved. Dr. Abraham makes the point that oftentimes, even though one can make the argument that who knows my parent better than I do, it's not the social worker, it's not the psychiatrist, it's me, the son, who knows better, that is a cogent argument. By the same token, Dr. Abraham points out in his discussion that oftentimes a child is not as equipped to deal with certain crises or problems that a patient who is demented or has Alzheimer's presents. And somebody who is skilled in that field, a social worker or a nurse or a psychiatrist, may be able to better deal with that situation. And therefore it's important, says the Rambam, not to think as a child that I have to do everything. That's part of kibud avim. Part of kibud avim is not only to know what I need to do, but sometimes to know when I need to withdraw. Sometimes when I need to let other things be done by others, and therefore maintain the dignity of my parent, maintain the respect of my parent, not violate it, not compromise it, because I would not be able to properly deal with it. One of the issues that comes up, Dr. Bennett referred to it earlier in passing, but I was listening, was the issue of how to halachically categorize somebody who is demented in terms of the obligation of that person to perform mitzvos. Now obviously it certainly depends on the stage, early, middle, late, advanced stage or not. Just to give you a brief discussion about what is to us normally conjures up a negative ideation, but wasn't necessarily meant to by the Talmud, is the term of shoteh. We usually define shoteh, and it may not be a correct translation, as somebody who's foolish, somebody who's mentally incapacitated. Perhaps a better term is somebody who's demented. That may actually be a better translation. I think the root of shote comes a little bit from the word lashut, to travel, to go astray, which may be indicative of some of the symptoms of a shote, or it may just mean somebody who has gone astray from normal functioning. So if you think about a shote not in the derogatory sense that unfortunately we've been inculcated with when we study and we learn that sometimes how a shote has a negative connotation, it doesn't. On the contrary, it's important to bear in mind that many poskim are of the opinion, many rabbinic decisors of the Prima Gaudim points out, that a shote is basically a b'nei mitzvah. A shote, somebody who is, let's say, advanced dementia, is basically involved and responsible for mitzvos, but there is an exemption if it's beyond that person's ability. In Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, for example, they discuss the possibility of a shote slaughtering animals for shchita, and that those animals may be kosher to eat if there was proper supervision over the shote. That forces some of the poskim to point out that a shote is not exempt from mitzvos absolutely, is not exempt from commandments. There are certain requirements and responsibilities that a shote has, depending on his or her abilities. It is clear, the poskim say, that it is absolutely forbidden to feed a shote, and if you want to define, if you want to, we'll come back to that in a moment, if you want to define an advanced Alzheimer's patient as being somebody who's so demented that they are in the category of shote, and therefore exempt from certain mitzvos, it is absolutely prohibited to feed them non-kosher. It's absolutely prohibited to disregard certain things and just say it's okay for them to do, or we can give them this product, or we can let them do this and that. Obviously, if they're turning on lights on Shabbos, that doesn't mean that you have to intervene and stop them. But to actively give them food, let's say, that's not kosher, is certainly something that is considered to be biblically prohibited to give to a shote, as it is to any person, whether it's a minor, an adult, a cheresh, somebody who's deaf and dumb, who's a mute even from birth, or a shote. That's something the post can point out. But the problem is that it's very difficult to clinically, halakhically, categorize somebody as a shote. It's not so simple. Dr. Abraham, after a long discussion about some of the issues regarding the definition of dementia and shote, concludes by saying, by quoting, I believe he quotes an opinion. Maybe I'll get it for you in just a second. Mikol ha'amor, yes, he says, from all of the discussion above, nira, shagam hayom, even today, e efshar l'kvua klalim. It's difficult to really pinpoint rules and criteria to define a shote who, with regard to certain mitzvos, may be exempt, but not completely, certainly not so. Alpi minikar shote potur min ha'mitzvah. Kol lefi kfiyas ha'fanah, one has to use a clinician and a rabbi to try to determine what is and what isn't the status of a shote. It is true that the Talmudic discussion of shote includes certain symptoms that are certainly consistent with dementia. For example, the Gemara says, "Uzehu shote hayotzi yechidi belayla," someone who wanders off by himself at night. And Alzheimer's patients will wander off daytime or nighttime. "V'halon beveis hakvaros," sleeps in cemeteries. "V'makreas ksuso," tears his own clothing, doesn't really take care of himself. And there's a question whether all of these criteria are needed or only any one of these criteria are needed. The Rambam seems to talk about that it doesn't necessarily even have to be perhaps these criteria. It can be other criteria where it's clear the person has a certain cognitive disability, a certain inability. So maybe, maybe not. It's not so clear. It's not so simple. We shouldn't automatically categorize parents who have advanced dementia or Alzheimer's as being in the category of a shote. I will tell you that from my privilege that I have every Friday, even when I was going to the seventh floor, the advanced patients, who if you look at them and you watch them, you see that they're not very talkative. Some of them talk and they repeat the same phrase over and over again. I used to feel complimented. One of the patients used to thank me for coming, and she repeated it time and time again. I started to think that maybe she didn't mean it as sincerely as I thought first. She kept repeating it, "Thank you so much for coming." But obviously she meant it. She just kept repeating it time and time and time again. But one thing I notice is that when you stimulate them, They oftentimes respond to stimulation, even the advanced patients. We would sing Shalom Aleichem, and some of them would be able to pick up the words. Some of them would be able to pick up the melody. There was one man, I think it was before Passover, that I did a little Seder with them. And I started to sing the Manishtan, and one man, who was not very talkative until that point, started to sing the Manishtan all by himself. That was not, and I certainly hadn't done that weekend in Mekka, only did that one time. And he was able to recall the Manishtana and sing it properly, better key than I was able to. And that's indicative of the fact that stimulation is something that certainly can enhance their productivity and their function. And it's important to bear that in mind and not assume just because they don't spontaneously say blessings that they don't or can't or won't or don't have an appreciation or an understanding of it. It's simply not accurate to assume that. There may be a point at which they become exempt from positive commandments, but the negative commandments do not necessarily become exempt with respect to them, and certainly we can't actively promote their lack of fulfillment of mitzvos in any way. There may be a time where certain articles of religion may not be appropriate for them to handle because of the sanctity of the article. But any particular issue needs to be discussed properly, both with social work and with rabbanim. In the few minutes that I have left, I just wanted to discuss one or two last ideas. And that is the idea of end-of-life issues regarding advanced Alzheimer's patients. Alzheimer's disease is in of itself, to the best of my knowledge, the clinicians are not here any longer. No, the clinicians are special. The ones who came for that. Dr. Bennett is an excellent clinician. In addition to being my president of AOJS. So you can clarify this for me. But to the best of my knowledge, Alzheimer's disease in and of itself, in terms of the neurophysiology of Alzheimer's, does not result in a shortened lifespan. What results in the shortened lifespan of many Alzheimer's patients are complications as a result of the dementia. So that at the end stage, the inability for the patient to eat on his own, or the requirement to put in a feeding tube, whether it's a nasogastric feeding tube or a peg through the stomach, and complications with that, aspiration, other problems that are complications of the disease but not intrinsic to the disease itself. Those are common complications to many, many clinical diseases, not specific to Alzheimer's, and it's because of those complications. So one of the issues comes up at end stage having to do with placing a feeding tube. If the patient is already at that stage of dementia and can't participate in the decision making regarding placing a feeding tube or not, that, as was pointed out, is probably a problem because that discussion probably should have occurred much earlier on, and there should have been an advance directive or a living will or some kind of healthcare proxy to indicate someone or something, someone to make the decisions or some decision that should be made. And it becomes a little bit more sensitive when you're talking about a patient who can't participate in his or her own decision-making and you're going to perform procedures, even though a PEG, a placement of a feeding tube, is certainly considered to be a fairly benign procedure that can be done within a half hour or less, certainly by a competent gastroenterologist. It takes an hour for an incompetent one. The competent one, within a half hour, it rarely involves complications in and of itself, and it is a generally comfortable tube that is certainly much more comfortable than a nasogastric tube, is certainly more comfortable than IVs, and patients can certainly be fed through it. But nonetheless, to put someone through that without being able to explain to them what's going on or elicit their response is not totally fair to them. And it should be done in advance and have them participate in events. If it got to the point where that wasn't the case, so I think that the general consensus of the postman would be that placing the feeding tube would be required, that we wouldn't be permitted to starve the patient, we would be required to place the feeding tube, unless the patient is literally fighting you physically and is really, really fighting physically and you have to restrain them, that has to be discussed. Rabbi Feinstein talks about in one of his response of the issue of not force physically, not force feeding a patient to be fed, but he says he's talking about a patient who's an adult bar das, who's an adult patient with decisional making capacity of his own, and you should never, he says, physically force someone to receive a treatment or to receive feeding. You should do everything you can to convince them of it. The problem is with an advanced stage Alzheimer's patient, you don't have that luxury of trying to discuss it with them. That's why it should be discussed before. But if it wasn't discussed, I would assume, I would think that it would be the rare rabbinic opinion who would say you should not put in a feeding tube. I would assume that it would be the mainstream, if not the overwhelming majority, bring decisive that you should put in a feeding tube and make them more comfortable with the feeding tube and allow them to continue to eat. Regarding the issues of end of life, and just to conclude perhaps with the issues of advanced directives and living wills, a person who is, even if one has the ability halakhically and clinically to categorize an advanced patient, an advanced Alzheimer's demented patient as being a shote, as being the demented patient that the Talmud talks about, and therefore has certain exemptions from certain religious activities, that in no way infringes upon our responsibility to maintain that person's life as long as possible with considerations of normal end-of-life issues, of their suffering, of their comfort, of their quality of life, and other considerations like any other end-of-life issue that we take into considerations. Half a dozen issues, and there are all kinds of opinions in the rabbinic community, what's right, what's wrong, what should be done, what shouldn't be done. We don't have time to go into that. Unless we're going to stay for dinner, but we're not staying for dinner. So it's important to point out, the Mishnah Berurah makes this point, that whether a person has a technical responsibility to perform mitzvot or not has no bearing on our responsibility to violate Shabbos for them, to violate Yom Kippur for them, to violate all of the halachas that we violate for anyone to save their life. The same applies to somebody who may be extremely demented. I have not seen, thank you for letting me know about that, I have not seen the new Aguda healthcare proxy living will. I've seen the old one. The Rabbinical Council of America also has a living will healthcare proxy, the two of which have absolutely no resemblance one to the other. They are two totally different documents, and it would be interesting for you to look at both and compare the two. I have a personal preference for the Aguda's. Maybe because I'm more simple-minded and I can't think so extensively. The RCA requires a lot more thought to be put in. The Aguda one is based, the old one at least, I haven't seen the new one, but the Aguda Living Will Healthcare Proxy is basically a healthcare proxy. It's not so much a living will as it is a healthcare proxy, which means it has a little bit of living will content, but it's basically a proxy. The difference between a living will and a healthcare proxy, they are both considered to be advanced directives, but a healthcare proxy means that I designate a person to make decisions for me in case I become incapacitated to make my own decisions. I don't have to say anything about what those decisions should be. All I have to do is designate a proxy, and that's fundamentally what the Aguda old version does. It designates a proxy to do so with some living will content. The living will means that I, in advance of becoming incapacitated, outline certain things that I would want done, outline certain things that I wouldn't want done in certain cases when I become incapacitated, giving certain medical scenarios. The RCA one outlines all kinds of medical scenarios, and at least for me, when I read it, it was a little bit overwhelming for me and difficult to try to address on a practical level. So my preference, when I recommend living wills to people, is to use the Aguda one with perhaps some modification, because it's basically, it's not a question whether it's the Aguda or the RCA, basically the idea is to have some kind of advanced directive in place where someone competent will be making decisions for a person, or where the person has outlined certain things that they want or don't want, or the best, perhaps, is a combination of a proxy and a living will. I'll just conclude with the comments of Rabbeinu Bachya. Dr. Abraham refers to this opinion of Rabbeinu Bachya on his commentary on the Aseres Hadibros, the Ten Commandments. Rabbeinu Bachya comments on the reward that a child is granted by God for servicing his parents and respecting his parents. And we know that that reward is l'man yarichun yamecha, that the children will be granted long life and longevity. So Rabbeinu Bachya says in a very insightful way in his commentary on Chumash, he quotes from Rabbi Sadia Gaon, Nasa tam b'zeh kin yivnei shelefa'amim asidim sheyichyu ha'avos im habonim zman arach. The reason why the Torah specified the reward of longevity with respect to honoring a parent is because the Torah understood that there may be many occasions where parents may live with the children for extended periods of time. And the parents may end up being a tremendous burden and hardship for the children. The hakavod yichbar aleihem, using the way Rav Sadia in his poetic way can, hakavod yichbar aleihem, the honor will become kaveh, will become a burden and heavy upon the children. Lakach, therefore, kava aleihem schar hamitzvah hazos. The Torah specifically designated and delineated the reward for this mitzvah, namely long life. Kolomar, alecha lechatam, you are still required to honor them, even if it's a long time that they're in your house, even if it's burdensome. V'tichyei imam, you must live with them. V'imulai titzdar al chayehem, and if it's uncomfortable for you, if it's distressful for you, their life. Da, you should know, she'al chayecha tomitzdar. You're being distressed over your own life, because the fact that you're servicing them and honoring them is the reason why you're able to live and live and live and have your own longevity. So if you're distressed over the fact that they're alive and burdensome, without them, well, perhaps our own lives might be shortened as well. I think the idea is more than just a question of long life as opposed to not. But I think that the ultimate objective, and one has to really think out how to accomplish this objective, the ultimate objective in caring for a parent, caring for an Alzheimer's patient, as we mentioned at the beginning, is not to categorically think that I must do everything and they must live in my house forever, and I should never put them in a proper institution. That obviously requires attention as to what a proper institution is. The point is that one must always take into consideration the welfare and the benefit of the patient, of the parent, and never feel that somehow this is a burden for us. But if it does become burdensome, as Maimonides writes, one has to know one's own limitations as well. One also has to know what the limitations of one's family is. It's not fair for me, this is something that last year Loris Yomim sponsored another presentation where Pershel Schechter, Shlita from Yeshiva University, my Rebbe, spoke. It's fair for a child to extend the burden to one's wife or children in a way that will be unbearable for them, particularly if the child goes away from home and goes to work and the rest of the family is obligated to then care for it. One has to be fair to one's parent, fair to one's family, and fair to oneself in the process, and try to come to a proper balance so that l'man yarichun yamecha, everyone can live a long life, not only quantitatively, but qualitatively as well. Thank you.